The title of your book, Dr. Gaber Mate, is The Myth of Normal: Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. So why don't we end with that question of healing, both individually and as a society?
Yes. So healing, again, if you look at the word origins, which I often do, comes from a word for wholeness. So healing actually is a movement towards our wholeness. Now, if trauma is a split from ourselves, for example, a split from our bodies, as in the case of V, who had to disconnect from her body to survive her childhood, then healing is that reconnection with ourselves. And if trauma is not what the terrible things that happen to us, but trauma is the wound that we sustained and are carrying, that's a very positive message, because it means that that wound can be healed at any time. You see, if the trauma is what happened to me now 77 years ago, that my mother gave me to a stranger, that'll never not have happened. But if the trauma is what I made it mean, the wound that I sustained, that I wasn't a lovable, worthwhile human being, that wound can be healed at any moment in all of us. So the last and longest section of the book explores what we call pathways to healing or pathways to wholeness. That's the meaning of healing. There are many different pathways. There's no one size fits for all. It needs to begin with the recognition that how we're living and how we're relating to ourselves and others is not healthy. It may be the norm in this culture, but it's neither healthy or natural, and there are better ways. And the same thing is true for our culture. And the essential first step is what I call being disillusioned. Now, people usually think of disillusionment as discouraging and somehow negative. No. Would we rather be illusioned or disillusioned? Would we rather see the world through rose-colored glasses, not seeing what's in front of us? Or would we rather deal with reality the way it is? In the final chapter, I quote James Baldwin, the great, great James Baldwin, who said that not everything that's faced can be healed, but nothing that's not faced can be healed.
Dr. Gaber Mate, the acclaimed Canadian physician and author with his son Daniel of the new book, The Myth of Normal: Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. Dr. Mate will be appearing tonight here in New York City at the 92nd Street Y, where he'll be in conversation with Tara Westover, the author of Educated. And that does it for our show. To see all our interviews with Dr. Mate, you can go to democracynow.org. Happy belated birthday to Sam Alkoff. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO News is proud to present our 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, and we want to hear your thoughts as we approach the midterm election. What do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card as a thank you. Plus, it will help our volunteer reporters cover the election with the info that you need to know. Find the survey online at bit.ly/KBOO-survey. That's KBOO's 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, available online through September 25th at bit.ly/KBOO-survey.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, new investigative reporting reveals Portland police failed to arrest a murder suspect for 2 years, despite having evidence. Governor Brown asks the president to declare a state of emergency for wildfires in Oregon. And former President Trump embraces QAnon. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 16th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. New investigative reporting by OPB appears to show that Portland police sat on critical evidence for 2 years before making an arrest in the 2019 murder of anti-fascist activist Sean Kelleher. Kelleher was run over and killed by a suspect in a silver Ford Explorer in October of 2019. The suspect, Christopher Knipes, was arrested on August 4th. Portland police had said they were working diligently on solving the homicide, but public records obtained by OPB tell a different story. Police had surveillance footage implicating Knipes for over 2 years before an arrest was made. The arrest also happened just as pressure from OPB and another outlet, The Intercept, were winning a case to publicize the status of the case since it had been 2 years since the killing. This week, the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office agreed with OPB that some of these records had to be made public. Records show that the lead investigator had found the identities of those in the car that night as early as January of 2020. Prosecutors say that the surveillance footage from local businesses obtained days after the crime show Knipes and an accomplice walking away from the fatal crash. Based on the records, the investigation seems to have stopped in February 2020 and wasn't picked up again until June of this year, when Knipes was again interviewed by police under mounting pressure from news outlets to account for what investigating police detectives had completed. The victim, Kelleher, was critical of police, which has led to some, including his mother, to question why the investigation has taken so long. Knipes faces charges of second-degree murder. His next court date is November 21st. Oregon Governor Kate Brown asked President Biden to declare a state of emergency for extreme wildfire risks this week. A federal emergency declaration would mean the state would get access to federal resources to help fight wildfires. There are currently 32 active wildfires in Oregon, and hundreds of thousands of acres are actively burning. The wildfire season is expected to last through October. Brown wrote her request to the president in a letter on September 9th, saying, quote, "Oregon would be the first state ever to receive such a declaration for wildfire response, but unfortunately, certainly not the last to need this important assistance," end quote. Brown wrote the letter ahead of the extremely dry winds that supercharged fires in much of the state. Many across the state have been without power as electric companies try to decrease the risk of new fires starting. If Oregon had federal aid at that time, they could have requested emergency generators that would have kept power on in those parts of the state. 70% of home buyers consider disaster risk when deciding where to live. So Realtor.com now shows the risk of wildfires for specific properties. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Prospective home buyers usually consider how many bedrooms and bathrooms a house has and its price per square foot. But that's not all.
7 out of 10 recent home buyers considered natural disaster risk when deciding where to live.
That's Sarah Brinton of Realtor.com. She says many buyers are growing particularly concerned about wildfires. So the real estate website now provides information on wildfire risk with a third-party tool called Fire Factor. It ranks properties on a scale from 1 to 10 based on their risk of being damaged by wildfire over the next 30 years. The ranking is based on projected regional fire risk as the climate warms and property-specific factors like topography and vegetation. Brinton says buyers value information about wildfire risk, and the ranking can also help sellers market a home. She suggests that sellers highlight steps they've taken to reduce a property's vulnerability.
If there is roofing that's less flammable, if they've removed brush from around the home or installed a sprinkler system or upgraded their windows to make the house more resilient to wildfire, all of those details are really important to feature in the listing.
So consumers can make informed decisions as fire danger grows. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A hailstorm in August devastated the small eastern Oregon community of Wallawa, but people in surrounding towns have come out to help our neighbors. Eric Tegetoff has more on their recovery.
After a devastating hailstorm in eastern Oregon, community members are lending each other a helping hand. In mid-August, a severe storm dropped hail the size of baseballs on the town of Wallawa. It damaged nearly every vehicle in the town of 800, smashed windows, and battered roofs. Stephen Cleaver is the pastor of Lustine First Presbyterian Church, which has congregants from nearby Wallawa.
I contacted everybody, made sure everybody was okay. What I found out was that people were highly traumatized. This was a traumatic event. It just shook people because it was so violent. I mean, we're talking 10 minutes, and it basically decimated the town.
He says luckily no one was seriously injured. After checking in with everyone he could, Cleaver headed an effort to raise money. He says so far they've raised $70,000 and handed out $500 vouchers. The most pressing need for people was transportation, since many in the community work outside of town. However, Cleaver says it wasn't immediately apparent how hard folks' roofs have been hit. They'll need to be repaired or at least patched before the cold, rainy winter starts. Cleaver says people from surrounding communities immediately stepped up and did what they could.
People put up plywood over windows. They helped put tarps over roofs. People jumped in and provided rides to people who needed rides for work.
Although the hailstorm damaged nearly every part of Wallawa, it did not reach the threshold for federal aid. The damage was assessed at less than $7.5 million, meaning federal emergency management agency support is not available. Cleaver says the type of support doled out from FEMA is typically for bigger, more urban communities.
This was a devastating event, but not in the eyes of the world at large. And so this is the kind of situation that falls through the cracks. And how could we revamp some of the criteria, for example, for federal aid that could take into account smaller communities, rural communities, remote communities?
So far, a GoFundMe fundraiser set up by Marika Straw has raised more than $36,000 for the people of Wallawa. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
Five of Oregon's major school organizations joined together to fight bullying. The Oregon School Activities Association, the State Board of Education, the Oregon Department of Education, the Oregon School Boards Association, and the Coalition of Oregon School Administrators issued a joint statement calling on adults at sporting events and other activities to watch out for harassing and bullying behavior and to interrupt it if seen. The statement points out officials are already required to enforce existing policies, but it adds a clause that, quote, spectators and other adults must set a good example by lifting people up, not tearing people down, end quote. It adds the comment students can come to events prepared to cheer and not bring negativity to others. The group said they have noticed increasing negativity, bullying, and hate speech and symbols at activities in recent years. Several incidents at school sporting events drew investigations last year, including racist behavior at high school basketball games and the use of racial slurs at a football game. The statement details six specific policies. First, that all coaches and referees must undergo training on how to interrupt discrimination. Second, that a complaint process related to sportsmanlike conduct will be created. The third policy is the Oregon School Activities Association's STAR Initiative, which is intended to disrupt racism and discrimination. The statement also references Oregon's Every Student Belongs policy, which prohibits hate symbols and speech at schools and school activities, and state requirements that school boards have policies prohibiting harassment and supporting equity, opportunity, and access for all students. The statement said, quote, when harassment or bullying happens at events based on age, disability, national origin, race, color, marital status, religion, gender identity, and sexual orientation, it violates civil rights laws that our organizations are required to enforce. End quote. Rail workers reach a tentative agreement with rail managers, and Minnesota nurses return to work after a three-day strike. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It sounds like the tentative agreement grants a single sick leave day, which is a bit of an insult, one would think.
Ron Kamenkow, organizer for Railroad Workers United, on the tentative agreement with rail companies. It would also let workers take unpaid time off to attend medical appointments without penalty and would increase worker wages by 24% over 5 years. The deal hasn't yet been approved by the rank and file, but it could avert a crippling strike that would halt U.S. rail freight. In Minnesota, 15,000 nurses returned to work after a three-day strike, the largest on record. Minnesota Nurses Association President Mary Turner said they're suffering from burnout and pay that hasn't kept up with inflation.
We have plenty of nurses, but we have nurses that don't want to work in the conditions that are out there. And I could say this message to every nurse in every state, and they'd understand what I'm talking about.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is standing by his move to ship two plane loads of migrants, most from Venezuela, to Martha's Vineyard. Critics charge he was using refugees from communism for a careless political stunt. Senate Judiciary Chair Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin addressed growing threats to law enforcement after being briefed by the FBI and Department of Homeland Security.
It was stunning, the number of threats that have been cataloged and indexed since the August 8th search at Mar-a-Lago. We've seen some very specific and others which are generalized and address the security of each and every federal agent.
At the White House Thursday, President Joe Biden hosted the United We Stand Summit. He called for action on the hate and violence shown at the January 6th insurrection and the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally.
Nazi flags and banners chanting the bile, accompanied by white supremacists. David Dukes and his crowd, and an innocent young woman is killed. When the last guy was asked, what did he think? He said he thought there were some fine people on both sides.
Social media platforms, including YouTube and Facebook, say they are taking action to stop violence against specific groups. And in California, Governor Gavin Newsom signed online transparency legislation he says will protect against hate and disinformation. But Twitter's former head of global engineering, Alex Roeder, says he's skeptical that the algorithms will change much.
So until those incentives change, we should not expect the AI to optimize for anything other than engagement and profit maximization.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 54 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will continue to be cloudy with a high of 69. Today in history, in 1975, Papua New Guinea gains its independence from Australia. The quote of the day is from legendary American blues musician B.B. King, who was born today in 1925. He said, "The beautiful thing about learning is that no one can take it away from you." President Trump appears to have openly embraced QAnon, a far-right political conspiracy theory and political movement. Earlier this week, Trump reposted an image of himself wearing a Q lapel pin overlaid with the words, "The storm is coming," on his Truth social platform. In QAnon traditions, the storm refers to Trump's final victory, when supposedly he will regain power and his opponents will be tried and potentially executed on live television. Experts worry his actions show that not only is he not distancing himself from political fringes, but he is actually welcoming being on the fringe. He has also publicized dozens of recent Q-related posts, in contrast to his behavior in 2020. Even at that time, he claimed that while he didn't know much about QAnon, he could not disprove its conspiracy theory. Trump's recent postings have included images referring to himself as a martyr fighting criminals, psychopaths, and the so-called deep state. In late summer, he reposted a Q-drop, a cryptic message board posting the QAnon supporters claim came from an anonymous government worker with top secret clearance. An Associated Press analysis found that more than one-third of the accounts Trump has reposted on his Truth social profile in the past month promoted QAnon by sharing the movement's slogans, videos, or imagery. Earlier this month, Trump chose a QAnon song to use at a rally in Pennsylvania. And the same song, entitled WWG1WGA, appears in one of his recent campaign videos. That acronym stands for where we go one, we go all. On Truth Social, QAnon-affiliated accounts praise Trump as a hero and savior and vilify President Joe Biden by comparing him to Adolf Hitler or the devil. Some accounts proudly display how many times Trump has re-truthed them. Janet McIntosh, an anthropologist at Brandeis University who has studied QAnon's use of language and symbols, says this behavior allows Trump to endorse QAnon believers' hope for a violent uprising without expressly saying so. She cites his recent post about the storm as a particularly frightening example. Others predicted that Trump may attempt to market Q-related merchandise or ask QAnon followers to donate to his legal defense. A growing list of criminal episodes has been linked to people who have expressed support for QAnon. Its supporters were prominent in those who stormed the Capitol in the January 6th insurrection. In November 2020, two men drove to a vote-counting site in Philadelphia in a vehicle adorned with QAnon stickers. Their Hummer was loaded with a rifle, 100 rounds of ammunition, and other weapons, and prosecutors believe they were trying to interfere with the election. Last Sunday, police fatally shot a Michigan man who they say had killed his wife and severely injured his daughter. A surviving daughter told the Detroit News that she believes her father was motivated by QAnon. The same weekend, a Pennsylvania man who had reposted QAnon content on Facebook was arrested after he allegedly charged into a Dairy Queen with a gun, saying he wanted to kill all Democrats and restore Trump to power. Many major social media platforms, including YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, have banned content associated with QAnon and have suspended or blocked accounts that seek to spread it. That has forced much of the group's activities into arenas that have less moderation, including Telegram, Gab, and Trump's Truth Social platform. The U.S. Department of the Interior launches a new co-stewardship program with tribes. With that story and more, it's Daniel Montaño with National Native News.
For National Native News, I'm Daniel Montaño in for Antonia Gonzalez. The federal government is following through on a promise to increase tribal input in managing federal lands. The Department of the Interior announced Tuesday new guidance and policy establishing co-stewardship of federal lands and waters. The National Park Service, along with the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, will work directly with Native tribes, Alaska Native entities, and Native Hawaiian communities, giving tribes a greater voice in protecting cultural assets and sacred sites. USA Today reports co-stewardship would give tribes decision-making legal authority, collaborative management responsibilities, and in some cases, complete self-governance. In addition, the policy calls for the NPS to reach out to tribes directly rather than waiting for tribes to come to them on any plans or activities that would have Native interests, practices, or traditional use areas. NPS Director Chuck Sams says he knows some Native communities will hold doubts, having heard similar promises before that bore little fruit, but this time he says they have friends in high places. Both Sams and Interior Secretary Deb Haaland are tribal citizens who have been working on getting more Native input into federal decisions for decades. The policy specifically includes, quote, non-federally recognized tribes, relocated indigenous people with a historic link to the area, and other traditionally associated peoples, aiming to add influence for people who have been overlooked in the past. The Cherokee Nation passed its largest ever budget this week, $3.5 billion. Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. says his top priority is expanding and strengthening the criminal justice system following the Supreme Court's McGirt decision, which changed the process of tribal criminal cases. Ann Descoy reports the budget increases funds for the Cherokee National Marshal Service by $6 million and adds money for more attorney general and judicial staff. All told, the budget forecasts 5,600 new tribal government employees. The plans also include more drug and mental health treatment facilities and expanding transportation services and infrastructure, including public housing. One of those investments is $400 million to replace a nearly four-decade-old hospital that was originally designed to serve 60,000 patients a year but has been seeing more than 500,000 patients in recent years. Hoskin said the new hospital will be six stories tall and more than twice the size of the current one, and that construction will begin within a year. The budget also sets aside more than $5 million for the government to transfer inmates who have sentences longer than 6 months to a facility in Central Texas. KOKH News reports with the McGirt decision expanding the prison population, even inmates found guilty of a crime could be released unless the transfer takes place. Hoskin says it's simply a matter of safety and capacity. The entirety of the Yakima Nation Council faces possible recall following allegations of misusing funds and efforts to protect six of its members from suspension. The Yakima Herald Republic reports an audit of Land Enterprise, a Yakima initiative that oversees and administers tribal land, revealed the alleged misuse of funds. The tribe's Code of Ethics Board performed the audit and investigation. The recall was sparked by the audit's findings that allegedly Land Enterprise managers received incentives, payouts, and wage raises while workers in other divisions were put on furlough or dismissed. The committee members that oversee Land Enterprise were accused of failing to impartially investigate those financial benefits and have been suspended without pay for 60 days. Four of them refused to cooperate with the investigation and were placed on probation until they comply. A recall meeting has been scheduled for October 12th when voting tribal members will decide if the council will be removed. For National Native News, I'm Daniel Montano.
After the passing of Queen Elizabeth, the international community has many questions about the new king. Will King Charles continue to support environmentalism on the throne? For that story and more, we go to This Week in Water.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Will the Green Prince be a green king?
The death of Queen Elizabeth last week has led to the ascension of a lifelong environmentalist to the British throne. However, King Charles III will likely be less of a climate activist than he was as Prince Charles.
50 years ago, when he was in his 20s, Charles spoke publicly of the danger of oil pollution destroying beaches and seabirds. He warned of factories contaminating rivers and polluting the air with smoke.
He's been an active supporter of wildlife conservation and anti-poaching efforts. In 2021, Prince Charles launched Terra Carta, a version of the Magna Carta, through which businesses were urged to recognize fundamental rights and the value of nature, including support for international agreements on climate, biodiversity, and desertification.
But now as king, he will have to express himself differently because of the traditional limits on the sovereign from taking an overt political stance on the UK's politics and its decision-making.
Holding his tongue in public on climate issues will likely be a challenge for the king, as his new Prime Minister Liz Truss is set on lifting a ban on fracking and approving more drilling in the North Sea to increase energy supplies. The country might also keep some coal plants operating that had been set to close this year.
However, Charles is expected to meet with the Prime Minister in private on a weekly basis, during which he may express his concerns about climate change.
And as far as climate change goes, it's not game over. Every fraction of a degree we limit global warming reduces the risk of hitting tipping points, after which significant changes to oceans and weather would be irreversible.
That's according to a new study that shows multiple tipping points could be triggered if global temperature rises 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels.
Once a tipping point is reached, even if temperatures stop rising, changes put in motion like melting ice sheets or disappearing rainforests will continue and become self-perpetuating.
Even now at 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming, the researchers say we are in the danger zone for 5 tipping points, including permafrost thawing that releases greenhouse gases and the disruption of the ocean currents in the North Atlantic, changing rain patterns which billions of people depend on for food.
If we do reach 1.5 degrees of warming, additional tipping points are possible, including changes to northern forests and losing all mountain glaciers.
But there is hope. The chance of crossing the tipping points can be reduced by immediately cutting greenhouse gas emissions.
We've all heard tales of the legendary Fountain of Youth, a mythical spring that can turn back the clock for anyone drinking or bathing in its waters. Immortality is fiction, of course, unless you're Turritopsis dornii, a tiny jellyfish the size of a fingernail that can return to its juvenile state, akin to a butterfly becoming a caterpillar again.
Scientists have known for a couple of decades about this so-called immortal jellyfish, which under stress from injury or a lack of food will reabsorb its tentacles and sink to the seafloor as a baby polyp to start its life anew.
Now, according to researchers from the University of Oviedo in Spain who sequenced the immortal jellyfish genome, we have an inkling as to how they defy death.
The team found that when compared to a related mortal jellyfish, Ceratopsis dornii has double the number of genes that repair and protect DNA, which allow it to produce more restorative proteins.
It also has unique mutations that prevent its chromosome's protective caps, called telomeres, which in humans tend to shorten with age, from deteriorating.
The researchers said their goal isn't to achieve human immortality, but rather that the genes they've identified could offer insights into numerous diseases associated with aging.
And finally, heat waves, drought, wildfires. California is grappling with severe challenges brought on by the climate crisis. So, to up its resiliency game, the state is turning to a creature once hunted nearly to extinction and periodically maligned as a nuisance, the North American beaver.
Sure, the rodent builds dams that divert waterways and cause floods, but it turns out that's a good thing. Those piles of sticks and mud create ponds and channels that spread water over the landscape, giving it more time to soak into the soil, which ultimately keeps plants green even during drought.
That's according to Emily Fairfax at Cal State Channel Islands, whose research in 2020 showed that during wildfires, areas where beavers were active remained lush, while adjacent land was scorched.
Given beavers' ability to protect and restore ecosystems, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife wants to enlist them as part of a nature-based, cost-efficient solution to the climate crisis and use their engineering skills to increase wildfire resiliency and boost biodiversity.
The department has posted its first job listings for senior environmental scientists who will oversee restoration efforts and reevaluate programs that installed beaver dam analogs that mimic the real deal.
So we're still friends, beavers? No hard feelings for those days of relocation and extermination?
Nah, that's water under the dam.
That's it for this week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see